All right, you intrepid hurly-burlyites. I'll get right to it. We've struck a brand new panel for today's pod and set aside a little extra time because I think it's going to be that rich a conversation. Three presidents from three of our leading Canadian universities are joining me for a high-level conversation about what the purpose of a university is. From there, we'll flow into issues of funding and accessibility, how the curriculum may have changed over time and changed the way students view Western civilization, and lastly, the research function of universities, and how that fits into Canada's efforts to spur innovation and productivity growth. Each of our president's CVs is long and accomplished, so I'll just apologize in advance to them for my brevity here. Let's welcome Merrick Gertler from the University of Toronto. Merrick is the 16th president of the university. Prior to that, he served as the dean of the Faculty of Arts and Science, where he championed important innovations in undergraduate teaching and learning. He's authored or edited 9 books and advised governments in Canada, the U.S., Singapore, and Europe, as well as the OECD and the European Union. Thanks for coming, Merrick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Peter Stoichev is here from my home province of Saskatchewan, the president and vice chancellor of my alma mater, the University of Saskatchewan. After serving as dean of arts and science, Peter was appointed the 11th president of the university in 2015. He's led it to become one of Canada's top research-intensive medical doctoral universities with global impact in water and food security, synchrotron science, medical imaging, and agricultural technology. Peter, thanks for making the time.
Thanks, David.
And Graham Carr, president and vice chancellor of Concordia University, joins us. Graham's previous leadership positions at Concordia include provost and vice president, academic affairs, vice president, research and graduate studies, and dean of graduate studies. He's a member of the Research Committee of Universities Canada and sits on the steering committee of the Montreal Climate Partnership. Welcome.
Good to see you, David.
Good to see you. I want to thank you all for joining me here on the Hurly Burly. Let's get to it. I mean, I am talking to people from institutions that I have some respect for. I went to two of them and the third wouldn't let me in. So, I've got that relationship with these people. I really did want to start off at 30,000 feet with you, which is, you know, we seem to be having a debate right now, not just in Canada, but other places, but certainly in Canada, about the value of a university education. And it's being viewed really in the context of the job market and about what it does to prepare or not prepare people for the job market and whether it's a worthwhile investment of time and money, etc. Governments seem to be getting away with funding universities less than they used to. So I have a point of view about this, but I'd really like to hear what the three of you have to say. And Peter, maybe I could start with you. What is the purpose of a university? What's it supposed to do?
Many things, but you can't ignore the fact that universities would not exist if we didn't have students. And so mainly they're in the business of educating people for the next generation of what our country, but we export tons of students around the world. Other countries need as well. Universities are also really innovative, and they're the source of a lot of creative thought and as I say, educating students that way. Many universities are research intensive. To a certain extent, all universities do research of all different kinds. That can help drive the economy and help entrepreneurship and innovation if funded appropriately to be able to do so. And I'm sure we'll be able to get into that as well. So, you know, I'd identify those things for sure. It is interesting. I just got back from Singapore and Hong Kong. You were mentioning that Merrick is involved with Singapore as an advisor. And we all do a lot of traveling around the world in our respective positions. And you're always hearing, David, that Canada has great universities and produces great talent that then finds its place around the world. So I think that's a large part of it, producing engaged global citizens, if you want to put it that way. They're extremely important, and Canada's very well known for having them. Maybe the last thing I'd say about that is just different from a lot of other countries, not all other countries, but a lot of other countries. You get a really good education at every one of Canada's, where are we at now, 97, 98 universities. There are different kinds of education, liberal arts exclusively in some places, much broader, more STEM-oriented in others. Doesn't matter. The point is that no matter what university you go to in Canada, you're going to get a really good education.
Graham, do you have any different take on what the purpose of a university is?
Well, I think I agree with what Peter said. Maybe I just add a couple of things, David. I think universities also have a very important role and mission to play for society and need to be conscious of their relationship to the communities that they're part of. Universities are one of the last institutions in society that can serve as real conveners to bring people together from different sectors, whether it's industry, whether it's government, whether it's the community sector, NGOs, to engage in co-creation of research or just discussions around issues that matter. And I think that's an important role that universities play. We're certainly, as Peter mentioned, we're magnets for talent in terms of drawing people from not just across Canada, but around the world to different parts of Canada to study, to learn, and in many cases to choose to stay here after graduation. And I think that's a vital contribution that we make as well, and one, again, that is quite unique to universities versus other kinds of organizations and societies. So I would add those two additional factors.
David, can I jump in? So I want to reinforce a few of the things that Peter and Graham have already said. I think it's important for Canadians to know what a unique niche Canadian higher education occupies in the world of higher education, and Peter alluded to this. I think it's a system which, better than any other national system that I'm familiar with, combines quality and access. As Peter said, you can get an excellent education at about 100 different universities across the country, the overwhelming proportion of which are public or publicly assisted. And that publicness is really quite important because there's also a mandate for access and inclusion, which is really critical. It's really two sides of the same coin here. So there are very few systems that combine excellence and access to higher education the way that we do. Now, hopefully we can get into some of the challenges that are undermining our ability to address both of those elements of our mission in a few minutes' time. But the second point I wanted to make is that there's actually a long-standing literature on the social benefits of and impact of universities in the economy, and more broadly, a literature that maybe we need to remind people of, which, among other things, concludes that people with university educations, all else equal, will have higher earnings lifetime compared to those who don't go, will have better health outcomes, they'll actually lead healthier lives. And these are all measurable and quantifiable. And third, are going to be better democratic citizens. They're more likely to register to vote and to actually vote, which again, in today's world, I think it is something that we cannot take for granted and should not forget. And maybe the last point I wanted to make, because I'm a cities guy, that, you know, I'm an urbanist, and Graham was alluding to this, universities play an increasingly prominent role in city building. I mean, each of us happens to be running an anchor institution in each of our urban regions in which we are situated. And I think that role has always been important, but I think the spotlight is on it today in a way that it hasn't been for a long time. And it's generally a really positive one. So those are a few additional aspects I think it's important to get on the table.
I've really noticed that last point in Winnipeg about the city building part of it, where the university made a big impact on the city. Okay, so where does job training come into this from the student's point of view? Is this the primary purpose of a university, to prepare somebody to have a skill or a a profession that they can then go out and practice and earn a living? Or is it more abstract than that?
Well, maybe I'll just kick off part of an answer to that. I don't think there's any doubt that a lot of students go to university with the aspiration of then having greater employment opportunities afterward. At the University of Saskatchewan, we've got 17 faculties or colleges and schools, as we call them, and the vast majority of them are professional. They're overseen by accreditation bodies. You know, I'm thinking here about medicine, engineering, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And students are enrolling in those colleges and in those programs because they're looking ahead to employment in those areas, no question about it. But that's not the only thing that a university does. And, you know, I prefer actually the language of education as opposed to skills acquisition or even training, if you will, although I don't think they're absolutely inaccurate. And you were alluding a little while ago to the humanities and the role that they play and so on. I mean, I don't think you go into biology or into English in my case because you see that that's going to be a direct line to some kind of employment. You are learning, and I think the term is appropriate, transferable skills. You are learning critical thinking skills. You are learning communication skills. You're learning what can amount to leadership skills, all the things that I think used to have the unfortunate language of soft skills around them, but are more, you know, human skills that are more and more valued by all kinds of employment sectors later on. I think I'd probably be speaking for all four of us on this call, you know, that we didn't go to university because we knew exactly what we wanted to end up doing. We wanted to hear what was going on, like what were the top thinkers thinking about the most important things that are going on in the world and have historically gone on in the world in order to see what kind of path we'd take in the future. Part of that's employment oriented. Part of it's just becoming a better, more informed, you know, as Merrick was saying, voting citizen.
Merrick, is this changing because the world's gotten more competitive? Like, I'm 61. I was in university in the 80s. I felt like I had time to fuck around in my BA and just learn. And I didn't feel pressure because I felt, even while it wasn't leading to a job, the world at that point, I felt comfortable I would get a job. I felt comfortable I would be fine. Is that different for kids these days?
I think kids these days and, you know, our students at many different levels in their educational journey feel higher levels of anxiety. There's no question about it. It's anxiousness over the state of the economy, compounded by having endured a pandemic, which I think just elevated the anxiety levels across the board. It's anxiety about the state of the planet, given, you know, the climate crisis that we are facing these days. It's anxiety related to global instability and, you know, geopolitical unrest and so on. All of these things, I think, contribute to that general angst that this generation is feeling. So coming back to your question, I think that there is a kind of a desire for some security, a desire to know that when they have finished their studies at university, they'll have some kind of marketable competency. But we have to help them appreciate that we need to equip them with much more than that, as Peter noted, that we need to make sure they have a broad base of knowledge, that they also know how to keep learning throughout their careers. You know, that the ability to learn new tricks as they move from one position in the economy, one job to another. Because we certainly know that the need to retool and to keep learning is going to be more intense over time. So it's that sort of meta skill that we are really trying to impart on them. And I think, you know, related to that is kind of curiosity, that desire, that thirst to keep learning. So we have to help them manage these two needs. We, yes, definitely have to address the anxiety that they feel and the stress, but at the same time, it's our responsibility to set them up for a lifetime of success, not just that first job.
And shitification. That's fun to say. And shitification. A hell of a word. Word of the year for 2023, according to the American Dialect Society. For those of you who've never heard it before, and shitification refers to the all too common technology phenomenon where the user experience goes to, well, shit, in favor of the tech company maximizing its own revenues and profits. Think about the declining usefulness and endless stream of unwanted ads on Facebook and Insta, and the just plain weird cesspool formerly known as Twitter. Yep, and shitification. But rest assured, Hurly-Burlyites, it has not yet infested every tech company, and it's here that I'll take you back to our presenting sponsor, TELUS. For weeks now, citing specific next-gen network examples in everything from electric and autonomous vehicles to autonomous mining, I've been talking about how TELUS has been reinvesting hundreds of billions of dollars to continually innovate so their technology advances and meets the evolving needs of Canadians. Think of the massive improvements made from 3G to LTE to 5G, or dial-up to DSL to fiber. Because of investments like these, we all get more stuff done in less time, and businesses create and deploy new products and services that end up being better for the end user. Technology that just makes life better? It's the opposite of shitification, legitification, green litification, big hitification. Are you listening, American Dialect Society? Graham, since I promised the University of Saskatchewan Faculty of Law that I would not practice law if they graduated me, I went into public opinion research and have done that for a living. And one of the most consistent differences in public opinion is whether people have gone to university or not, when you're looking at the crosstabs. People who've gone to university have different opinions on things than people who don't. They approach problems differently than people who haven't been to university. They absorb facts differently than people who haven't been to university. And this is not a post-secondary, non-post-secondary difference. People who go to community colleges, for example, think about things the same way people who only have high school think about them. It's university that's the difference maker. What happens in university that does that?
Well, I think one of the things that's true about universities is that as a student, you have the opportunity to be exposed to an incredible diversity of people, an incredible diversity of points of view. And as you know, Merrick said, to embark on a voyage of discovery and exploration, if we're talking about the classic 18 to 24 year old cohort, that's a pretty formative moment in people's lives where a lot of change is possible. And I think if you take advantage of what university has to offer, and again, I think this is particularly the case for the larger urban universities that we all represent, you're getting that exposure to a breadth of the world that you might not otherwise if you weren't attending education. And, you know, I look at my university, there are students from 150 plus countries, and I'm sure that's true at U of T and probably not far off at Saskatchewan. That diversity is one of the richest realities of being at Concordia. And you're exposed to people who literally speak a different language, have different cultural values, have a different world experience. And that's a pretty rich environment in which to grow and to learn to think differently about maybe some of the things that you took for granted when you arrived at university. You know, for me, some of the most heartening stories when I talk with alumni are about how the university experience was transformative for them. And the opportunity to change people's lives. Some of that change happens in the classroom, but I think if we're talking about the 18 to 24 year old cohort, a lot of that change happens because of the environment of the campus and what the university has to offer. And again, I think it's that richness, not just of the opportunity to learn inside the classroom, but the opportunity to grow outside the classroom that differentiates the university experience.
Okay, so that feels to me like a description of going to liberal arts. What about commerce or business? So, Merrick, you have a highly acclaimed business program. There's also a lot of colleges in Ontario that offer business courses, business programming. Mm-hmm. What would be the difference in getting a business degree from U of T versus a business degree from a college?
Wonderful question. Well, I think the most obvious difference is that if you look at the structure of our undergraduate Rotman Commerce program, first of all, the program is the joint venture between the Rotman School of Management and the Faculty of Arts and Science. And in the first year, all commerce students do a broad base of courses, again, across a whole variety of different disciplines. As they go through, you know, successive years, they become more and more specialized in terms of commerce. But this was a decision that the University of Toronto made about 100 years ago. We're actually celebrating the centennial of commerce at U of T. As one of the ways to really both provide an excellent grounding for future business leaders and also to differentiate the kind of commerce program that we offer from those that would be available through some of those other institutions that you recommend. And I have to say that, experience suggests that we've been very, very successful, just judging by what our graduates have done.
Right. I think it's still the case, Peter, that people with a liberal arts undergrad will make more money over the course of their lives than people that don't, on average. Since they're not leaving with a skill, why is that?
Well, there are lots of reasons why you're, let's say, more employable after having a humanities degree or a social sciences degree. You know, one thing that I like to point to is there's a group in California, Silicon Valley, of the top 100 Canadian successful startups and SMEs and bigger than that. Firms, the C100 as it's called, 85% of them or so, at least as of a couple of years ago, were started by people who had humanities degrees. So there's something going on there, right? Some way of being able to look at the complexities of the world and narrow them down to things that are understandable, communicable. Ways of understanding how lots of complex systems work and, you know, how to be correctly informed and distinguish between stuff that is right and stuff that's wrong. And in fact, David, I was just thinking as my colleagues were talking about effectively the value proposition of universities, and it'd be great if we could dig even deeper into that. I mean, I think the pandemic showed us a lot about that, that it is really useful to be able to distinguish between, truth and its many imposters. I think you could even argue, I'm not about to do it, but you could even argue that somehow or other, our complete education system from K to 12 and right through all varieties of post-secondary have somehow failed us. I mean, you look back over what's happened over the last several years and a lack of value being placed on the difference between what's right and what's wrong, what's true and what's not true. And somehow a lot of stuff has slipped through the mesh there, right? I don't know where the problem lies. That's a different discussion. But I'm just saying, you know, there is something about a university education that teaches you to be critical of what you're hearing in the humanities. I'm sure it happens in others as well, but since you asked about the humanities, you know, being really deeply critical about what you're being told and assessing it and understanding how to assess the validity of it. And that's going to take you a long way in employment and companies, employers of all kinds are going to want to have that kind of incisive mind that's able to do that because their success is going to be based on it. That's one answer to your question anyway.
All right, Graham, I want to switch to access because we've been talking about the value and we're establishing a value. So now I want to talk about access. So it feels to me like not long ago in my life, university was thought to be a universal good and that everybody who wanted to go should be encouraged to go. And governments were trying to put in place financial incentives. A government I was part of, Kathleen Wynne in Ontario, was trying to basically eliminate tuition as a barrier to participation in post-secondary education. And I remember hearing Tom Friedman from the New York Times say that the genius of American society had always been that they educated their population to the technology of the times. And so they first had universal primary, then they had universal secondary. And he said, the times now call for universal post-secondary. That was about 10 years ago when he said that. I don't really hear much of that anymore. And I hear a lot more talk about whether a lot more utilitarian analysis of universities from a job career standpoint. And there doesn't seem to be this notion that everybody should go. In fact, people explicitly say now it's not for everybody. You should go get a trade. You should go do this or that. So, Graham, the question is, if not everybody should go, who should go?
Well, just on accessibility, I have to say, David, I mean, you're talking to somebody who's the president of a university that has prided itself on accessibility and excellence from day one as an alternative pathway for students, principally in and around Montreal and in the origin days of Concordia. But that accessibility is still very, very strong, and especially in Quebec, which has the lowest tuition rates of any jurisdiction in North America. And that's been designed on purpose by as a kind of social contract, if you will, with the government of Quebec to try to address the relative lack of university formation in Quebec historically, and to make universities in Quebec a far more attractive proposition, which is also one of the reasons why in Quebec the Université du Québec system was created and campuses were set up in regional centers like Rimouski or Abitibi-Témiscamingue, again to provide access. So I think that still remains a very important part of the social contract. What it's also meant, Peter referred earlier to the fact that there are 96 or 97 universities across the country, is that there's an extraordinary choice out there for prospective students. There's an extraordinary choice about the kinds of programs, the size of the university, the location of the university. And that's a much different environment from what existed even 20 or 25 years ago Canadian university systems. So I think that the emphasis on choice, the reality that Canadian universities remain incredibly accessible, certainly by comparison with the United States and by comparison with many other jurisdictions in the world, you know, that's still true. And the reality is our student population has been growing massively over the last number of years as well. So I think the proof is also in the numbers. Is university for everyone? No, but it's never been for everyone. And I think what we see now, though, within universities is that there's a far more diverse range of offerings available to students. And also, and this is not insignificant, much greater attention to trying to better support students on their journey from the moment they arrive until the time they graduate. And that also includes, you know, helping students who've chosen the wrong major, need to switch, which is a pretty common experience, or running into academic difficulties of one sort or another. So I think the attention that universities are paying to trying to support students in their success is different today from what would have been the case when any of us were students.
David, I'd love to speak to this issue as well.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah. You know, your question, I think, highlights the fact that the commitment of our various governments across the country to supporting higher education has been, let's just call it, intermittent at best and somewhat inconsistent from one provincial jurisdiction to another. Graham comes from a jurisdiction where, indeed, you know, the provincial government has quite deliberately invested in the system, kept tuition fees low, and so on, in order to enhance access. In Ontario, it's kind of a different story, where just to kind of give you a sense of the change, when my good friend and predecessor, Rob Pritchard, was president of U of T back in the 1990s, about 80% of his operating budget came from the government of Ontario, at least at the start of his term. That changed over time. Today, it's 20%, right? So barely one-fifth of our funding comes from the province. The rest of it is made up for primarily by student tuition fees. And so, the way in which education has been financed has undergone a profound transformation in this province. We've seen a lot of subsidiary issues come to the fore as a result of that. But the point of it is that it's become much less public. So the onus is really on individual institutions to try and make up the difference. The University of Toronto in 1998 passed a resolution unanimously at its governing council that really articulated a student access guarantee that said no student who's good enough to get into U of T should be prevented from entering or completing their degree programs for reasons relating to financial need. And as a result of that commitment, which we have honored consistently, you know, we're now spending close to $400 million a year from our operating budget and some from our endowment income in order to make good on that pledge. But it's becoming more and more challenging all the time, I have to say.
So, last month, without trumpets or drums, as the French say, our sponsor CN set a record. It moved more Canadian grain out of Western Canada than any other February in Canadian history. This was just the latest in a string of broken records. Now, some of the railway's detractors will get up on their hind legs and say, well, let's not forget February 2024 had 29 days, not 28. True. But here's the thing. CN beat the record in 28, didn't need 29. Others will complain that, well, we are in the middle of the first El Nino since 2016, which brings warmer weather, which makes it easier to haul freight in January. True. But please, railways don't set records because of intermittently unseasonal weather resulting from warmer water in the Pacific. CN has been on a record-breaking streak because it has changed the execution of its mission, which is to haul its customers' cargo safely and smoothly and efficiently. In the past few years, the railway has gotten back to a crucial basic, punctuality. CN trains now leave the station on time, every time, or the boss will want to know why. As I have said here before, that's not as simple as it sounds. It means razor-sharp scheduling on a busy network that spans North America east to west and deep into the south. It means ensuring tracks are clear and that trains don't sit for hours during station stops. Rigid insistence on sticking precisely to schedules provides crucial certainty for shippers and customers. They get the space they need for their cargo when they need it, and they can be certain it will arrive on time. That's a big deal, and it sets records. Oh, incidentally, expert forecasters are saying El Nino will almost certainly transform in a few months into El Nina, the sister system to El Nino. La Nina cools the Pacific and creates a whole different set of weather issues. CN is aware, and it will be ready. Peter, I walked down to the University of Regina in August of 1980 and signed up for my first year, and it cost me $800 for the year. I remember it extremely well. It was $100 a course, $400 a semester. Inflation would have taken that. So that was my family. My mom was a teacher, single parent, income, one income. Teacher. $400 was easily affordable. I lived at home. I had a job. summer job, etc., easily affordable. With inflation, that would be about $2,700 today. But an actual undergrad arts degree at the University of Regina is $9,000, three times what it would be according to inflation. I don't think I could go, Peter.
You'd be going under different circumstances, let's put it that way. I don't know that you'd be prevented from going, but it's a kind of different proposition now. The statistic I was aware of a few short years ago, was that on average, at least 50% of students at universities are not completing their degrees within the typical sort of 3 years for a three-year degree, 4 years for a four-year degree. They're taking longer. Why? Because they have to work as well in order to be able to afford it. I think that's going to be part of it. There's no doubt about it. You know, the flip side of that coin is that it's still a very affordable, terrific education. Back to the point I was making quite a while ago, that no matter where you go in this country, you are going to get an excellent post-secondary education at a Canadian university. So you're getting good value for your money. Back to the answers to a bunch of your other questions there about, you know, what happens after you graduate from university and are you employable and what's the route to that? I think all of that is very, very positive, but it's still a very accessible and affordable system that we've got here in comparison to a lot of other universities. Merrick and Graham could talk at length about the fact it's true here at the University of Saskatchewan, too, that when you are seeking philanthropic support for your university, you're really looking, I mean, you're looking for a lot of things, but one of the main things you're looking for is student support, scholarships, bursaries, all kinds of ways to offset those increased tuition costs. And there are other increased costs too, just cost of living and all sorts of other things that you just alluded to, David. And I think that, you know, the investment in universities by people who want to see students succeed regardless of the incrementally increasing costs, you know, that investment is going up. Could I just say one other thing, though, back to your earlier question to Graham about access and who should go and who shouldn't go? One other way of looking at that, David, is, you know, back when I came to the University of Saskatchewan in 1986 as an assistant prof in the English department, I came from the University of Toronto. I've been teaching there for 3 years on a contractually limited term appointment. Had the time of my life there, had the time of my life here too. It was really different here. This was still a university where
there's no Buds on Broadway in Toronto.
And there is not. Yeah. And it's still here, by the way, thriving. You know, it just looked different here. I mean, this was a university where the student body was primarily white. I think that was a reflection of the demographics of the province, with one huge exception. I just wanted to make sure that this got said from at least the Saskatchewan point of view, that about 15% of the population here is Indigenous, and I don't know, like 1% of the student population was probably Indigenous back in 1986, if that. But what has happened in terms of accessibility is that all sorts of people who did not have access to universities, either implicitly or in some cases in this country historically, explicitly, now definitely do. And this is why it's so tragic, in fact, to see south of the border, don't want to see it creeping in here, this resistance to EDI. That's a whole other topic that we could get onto, but I'm just pulling up one corner of it, which is that there's a lot greater accessibility here, much more openness in our universities now based on race and ethnic background and physical abilities and anything that you want to look at in terms of the EDI categories. This is really, really important. So, you know, I don't want people to think, I don't want the Canadian public to think that somehow or other, you know, the storyline is universities have gotten more expensive, it's harder to go, there's actually less access. It's it's very different from that. And then back to the points that my colleagues were making a few minutes ago, as a result, campuses are really diverse. And man, like, you learn a lot from that diversity. Everybody does. People who come here from other countries, people who are from Canada and see people from other countries, other ways of thinking, the empathy that you learn, the insights that you learn. These are really rich environments now. And I think the value proposition in terms of tuition and so on still makes a lot of sense. It's really attractive.
But in your ideal world, would they be lower? Are they good value for students right now, or should they be lower?
They being tuitions?
Tuition fees, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think we'd all love to say you don't need to pay anything to go to university. I mean, you know.
Well, sorry, let me stop you. That's an interesting value proposition. You're suggesting, as I would agree with, that money should not be a barrier to university participation.
Well, and I think, you know, as I say, universities have designed and constructed lots of different ways in which it is less of a barrier and to a lot of people, not a barrier at all.
Right.
But, you know, on the other hand, let's put it this way, somehow or other, the education system has to be funded in order to be excellent, right?
So and, true.
And everybody's got to participate in that.
Yeah. And to jump in again, there are systems around the world where education is free. You know, a lot of the Northern European countries, for example, Germany is a famous case in point. You know, and again, higher education economists have looked at this. The participation rates are actually not much higher than they are here. So while, you know, there's a kind of intuitive sense that the lower the tuition fees, the greater the access, what in effect happens is that those systems, they have limits. They don't have endless capacity. So they use other mechanisms for rationing access. And it's typically, you know, of an academic nature. When you look at the diversity of the student body in a country like Germany, it's actually nothing like what we have in Canada. And so that suggests to us that a better system from a social outcomes point of view is one where you charge a reasonable tuition fee, but where universities have both the wherewithal, perhaps a requirement, to recycle a significant chunk of that tuition revenue from students who can afford to pay to those who can't. And that is, you know, I think, in essence, the kind of system that exists in most of the provincial jurisdictions across the country. And I would argue is a better way of providing access if that's really what you're interested in.
There's other ways of looking at access too. And Graham, I'd be interested in knowing how smart I'd have to be to go to university right now. So my grade 12 average was around 80, and I didn't sweat that at all because I knew that was going to be easily good enough for me to get into the U of R. Would I get in today?
I can't tell you about the U of R, but I can tell you that at Concordia, first choice students coming to Concordia are inevitably in the B to A and above range. That's just a reality with one important difference, and that is the opportunity for mature students who've not done well at the high school or college or CEGEP level, or maybe never even pursued education after high school, that they also have an opportunity to pursue a university education based on their maturity and based on their experience in the workforce. So again, you know, important to understand that there are different profiles of students. We're talking a lot about 18 to 24 year olds, but in our universities, there's another cohort of students, graduate students, probably make up 15 to 20% of our student population, who are typically older and a very different profile, and a large number of people returning to university seeking micro credentials or seeking to upskill So the profile of the university student population, it's not defined exclusively by the 18 to 24 year olds, certainly at universities such as ours. But there's no question, David, I think the bottom line, the essence of your point is, you know, you have to be able to demonstrate that you're performing well academically to get admission to higher education. That's I don't see anything particularly unusual about that.
No, it's a question of where the cutoffs are, I guess, and maybe Merrick could jump in here, but but I mean, if you have to have more than 90 to get in, I don't know whether there were two or three people in my grade 12 class that had a 90 average. Not many, right? So are you excluding people who, like for instance me, who would be reasonable university students but aren't coming in with a 90 something average?
Well, you know, the answer is yes, sadly, in many programs. You know, to get into applied science and engineering at U of T or Brockman Commerce, you do need you know, an average in the mid 90s or even high 90s. So and we have no shortage of applicants who meet that requirement, but we've got thousands more who are extremely good but not quite good enough. And so there's a kind of a pathology in our current system that we can't accommodate those incredibly qualified and eager and willing prospective students, which speaks to your earlier question, David, about, you know, the extent to which we are funding our public higher education systems. In this case, it's not so much about where we set the tuition fee, is, you know, how many spaces we make available. We all have systems where the capacity for domestic students is very tightly regulated by our provincial governments. And we've been arguing for some time that actually there's a very strong need and I think a social rationale for expanding the system, because demand is huge and it's not softening at all.
Maybe, David, if I can just provide an example of that from a different perspective. So we have the largest film school in Canada, and we have routinely 700 plus applications for 70 positions. So 10% success rate. The challenge for us is not that we wouldn't like to accept more students. We just don't have the physical capacity and the financial capacity to accept them unless we get investment from government to support new buildings, et cetera. You know, we've tried to address that need by creating some micro-credential programs with the film industry that would provide more opportunities for potential students interested in film careers. But I think that's an example of the bottleneck challenge that universities face. And it's not exclusively in the professional programs, like business or engineering or nursing or medicine. It's in high demand programs. In our case, something like cinema, or to take an example at the other end of the spectrum, aerospace engineering, where, again, probably the single most difficult program to get admission to at Concordia, with a cutoff in the mid 90s.
Interesting. Okay, with your permission, I'm going to switch to talk about culture and universities a little bit, and just set this up a little bit provocatively for you, but I think what I'm saying is true. Conservatives are up in arms about the culture in universities. There's more about this in the States than in Canada, but you hear it in both places, and we import some fights from the States in this country from time to time too. So feel free to tell me that. But we all hear stories about the shift to teaching the stories about those who were colonized instead of the stories of those who colonized them. Much less interest in Western culture. Some professors talk about a rigid, woke orthodoxy that strangled opposing points of view. Now, universities have always been more left-wing than the general population. I mean, when I went to the U of R, the right wing of the political science department was held up by the one new Democrat who taught there. Dan DeVlieger, I'll say his name. I remember him still. He was NDP, so he was the right-wing guy in the political science faculty. So that's always kind of been the case. But is there something new here? Is there something different about the curriculum that is manifesting itself? You know, for instance, in recent hot button issues like the conflict in Gaza, we've seen very, very different attitudes among people 18 to 24 than people older than that. And some people speculate that that's partially a consequence of university curriculum. So what's going on in universities? Something I should be concerned about?
Well, I'll start off and try to answer that one. Yeah, thanks for asking it. I think, first of all, we're in a time of real change right now. When people confront me with the fact that the kinds of things that you're saying are endemic at universities and that this is therefore a problem, I say, you know, one of the options is that we never changed. Curricula never changed. The demographics of the student body therefore never changed. Nobody other than whoever was attracted to universities in the first place is ever attracted now or given access. Nothing changes. But we're in a time of really rapid change. And I think it's been so rapid, in fact, that this is what's causing quite a number of people, I guess, to have some kind of backlash against. And I think it's going to take time for things to continue to change. I do think, though, that universities can at times do a better job, again, of explaining why these things are happening and that they, in fact, are not bad. The word orthodoxy, I think, is a perilous one because it suggests that there is some kind of rigidity that now we're locked into that is never going to change. I just can't imagine that that's the case. But, you know, I'd start off with those observations, David.
Right. Graham, Concordia has always been a hotbed. Used to be a route to being a senator was blowing up computers at Concordia.
Glad you put the emphasis on used to be. Yeah, well, that's again part of what makes Concordia an exciting place, right? It's always had a bit of an edge to it. I think Peter and Merrick and I have all been introduced data that shows something very troubling about how universities are perceived in society. I think our status as trusted institutions has gone down, unfortunately, over the last couple of years, notwithstanding, you know, the incredible contributions that universities made during COVID, for instance. And to Peter's point, I think that as university leaders and believers in the higher education community, we need to ask ourselves why that change is happening, why that perception is shifting, and what we need to do to address it. I'm very concerned, particularly when I see what's happening in parts of the United States, not everywhere, but in parts of the United States, that universities have also become a kind of a soft target, a proxy location for settling all kinds of other scores in society. And something else is switched in that. It used to be that I think universities were seen as a reflection of society, and now I think as a reflection of some of the problems and challenges that society was facing. And now what I see is commentators sort of insisting that universities are the cause of some of the problems or contributing to some of the problems. You know, in the last few weeks, for example, Concordia has been in the pages of some Canadian newspapers around decolonization efforts, decolonization of curriculum. And frankly, some of what I've read in that bears no resemblance to what we're trying to accomplish at the university, but it fits a very nice political narrative. And I'll just give you one example. You know, there was a criticism of decolonizing the curriculum in engineering and computer science. Well, what would that mean? Well, the reality is, of course, and we all have engineering programs, that engineering programs are accredited, and the demands of the curriculum are very clearly set out and universally applied in Canada, and there's not a lot of flexibility. And engineering students generally have very few options to take elective courses. We created a department a number of years ago called Engineering and Society because we thought it would be useful for engineering students not just to do their standard engineering courses, but to begin to think about what the implications of applying their engineering skills in certain social contexts might be. It's not obligatory, it's optional. And one example of that, to get back to the decolonization perspective, is introducing engineering students to a better understanding of Indigenous cultures in Canada. So if you're an engineer working on, you know, one of the great green technology projects, of which there are hundreds in Canada that are taking place on Indigenous lands, maybe it's helpful to you as in your profession as an engineer to understand something about the community dynamics, to understand something about the values of the community and with which you are working. And somehow, you know, those initiatives are now being portrayed as contrary to the values of a liberal education, where I see them as enhancements to the liberal education and a reflection of the reality that our society has changed and that universities should change in relationship to that as well.
So, Merrick, I'm a 61-year-old white guy. And I grew up thinking that Western civilization was a pretty cool thing and that Canada was perhaps the best exemplar of that, a progressive and essentially good nation. And nothing that I learned in university really put a lot of nuance around those things, but didn't confront those things. Now we hear that we're colonizers, that we're guilty of genocide, that we're allied with all the wrong people in the world. Is that a healthy view of ourselves?
Well, it may be an uncomfortable view, but for the reasons that Graham and Peter have suggested, you know, we have a responsibility, I think, to help uncover stories that haven't been told before, and to make sure that that everyone's voice is heard. I mean, Graham's a historian, so he can comment on, you know, how this has transformed the discipline that he works from. And I think it has to transform the way that we think about curriculum. And I love his example of, you know, preparing engineers in the way that he described. But, you know, to sort of zoom out a little bit on this topic and the issue that you raised, I do think that universities, notwithstanding our responsibility to bring other voices in, have a responsibility to make sure that all voices feel like they could be heard. And, you know, in my view, part of the reason for the backlash, the hysteria around woke orthodoxy and wokeism and so on, arises from the kind of sense that they, universities haven't done a good enough job of making sure that everyone can be heard, and that those who have alternative perspectives, which ironically these days means more to, say, the writer, you know, the right half of the political spectrum, that they have been crowded out or drowned out in some way. And so
that is statistically true if you look at faculties, correct? Over time?
Apparently, you know, if you look at opinion-based research and so on. I think we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and say collectively, you know, are we doing a good enough job of providing both opportunities for everyone to express their views, no matter where they are on the spectrum, if you want to reduce it to a single dimension, but also, are we doing enough to support and enable people to argue with one another across different perspectives from different positions, and to hear one another and engage successfully? And I think on both of those fronts, we've got work to do. And I'm happy to elaborate further on it. But I do think that that's at the root of the complaints that you referenced earlier.
Have the students changed? Are they different? I went into universities completely deferential to the institution. I didn't think I had any right to have a say about the curriculum. I didn't think I had a right to have an opinion about the professor. I didn't think I had a right to anything other than to show up in class and do what I was supposed to do. And now, you know, I mean, generally one might observe among young people today perhaps a greater emotional fragility than existed back then, and perhaps a greater sense of entitlement than existed back then. But I hear from young people now who go to university that it's not accommodating to them, and that they hear ideas that are offensive to them. The notion, Peter, that a professor would not be allowed to offend me by teaching something that was true would have been ridiculous to me in 1981. Are the kids different now?
Well, I've heard some of those things myself. I don't know that I've experienced them directly. You know, I would imagine, David, back when you were a student, though, you certainly felt that you could argue with the professor, dissent with, you know, yes, from what the professor was saying. In fact, I would bet that you did a lot.
But I would never have felt that, yeah, did a lot, but I would never have felt that he didn't have or she didn't have a right to say what they'd said.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think those things are happening in the classrooms and at in universities across this country and far beyond, too. But I think it's incumbent upon a faculty member to, you know, have thought through and anticipated that kind of thing and articulated why, in fact, it is fair, appropriate, and legitimate to have the kind of conversation that, let's say, the student is objecting to, because the student's going to come out of that more resilient, better informed, stronger, you know, as a result. So I don't know. It might be that the argument intensity has ramped up, but I think you know, students are still getting a great education and working through these things.
Graham, is there a special challenge for Concordia because of the French-English dynamic? I mean, what we're kind of talking about is the extent to which universities exist outside of the popular culture that they're in and are seen as perhaps a threat to the popular culture that they are existing in. And I'm wondering if that's even more pronounced in Quebec, where is an English institution like Concordia viewed, an English multicultural organization like Concordia viewed as a threat in Quebec?
Well, that's become a loaded question in the last couple of months, David. Obviously, I think you've been following the... to put it in bon Québécois, c'est rock and roll in Quebec these days for Anglophone institutions, with government making adjustments to tuition policy, which are clearly designed to shrink McGill and Concordia, to shrink our size, placing expectations on the universities, which we were voluntarily committed to anyway, to work with our students to better learn French and integrate it into Quebec society after they graduate. Look, the profile at Concordia is that between 20 and 25% of our students are Francophones. You know, there's a reason why students from the Beauce or from East End Montreal or from elsewhere in Quebec are studying at Concordia. It's, again, the quality of the programs, number one, but it's also the opportunity to study in English and develop an important global skill, just as learning French is an important global skill for non-Francophone students who study here. My own reading in the situation for Anglophone institutions in Quebec is that the split is really a bit about Montreal and the rest of Quebec society. Montreal is a tremendous university city. Obviously, Concordia and McGill have been a big part of that for a number of years, as have Université de Montréal and UQAM and other institutions. But Montreal is also an extraordinarily diverse and cosmopolitan city, somewhat in comparison to the rest of Quebec. And unfortunately, in the last several months, there's been a bit of a target put on Quebec as the last stand for the defense of French in North America, and perceptions that the French language is undermined in Quebec, and that a major cause of that is the predominance of the Anglophone institutions. These discussions have not been very data rich, if I can put it that way. There are a lot of anecdotal points of evidence or non-evidence. There are a lot of stereotypes and caricatures, because the Concordia of today, serving a significant Francophone population and really embedded in Montreal and Quebec society, you were talking at the beginning of the podcast about training students for job skills and jobs in the future. You know, we have a huge co-op program. We had more than 4,000 students in co-op last year. A lot of those students are working in Montreal-based companies. They're integrating into Francophone working milieu. But the perception somehow is lagging in terms of our organizations. I think it's very unfortunate for Quebec. I think it's very unfortunate for Montreal, considering that for the last 20 years, people from across the political spectrum had worked to build this city up as one of the great university cities in the world, and they were successful in that. And I'm concerned that the political decisions of the last few months are tarnishing that reputation. Of course, it'll be to the benefit of Merrick and to Peter, but it's not great news for us. And I think it's also not great news for a large number of big corporations, multinational enterprises who deliberately set up shop in Montreal because they knew they were going to get an extraordinary access to talent in this city. And so for all of those reasons, I think that this particular resurgence of the linguistic tensions, for somebody who's a Quebecer born and bred, I find this particularly challenging to live with, because it's not a discussion around a reality. It's very much a discussion around a perception of a reality, and that's having negative consequences, not just for our institutions, but the ripple effect for that on the city is going to be significant, I'm afraid.
I'd like to delve more into that, but I think it would get us all in trouble. So I'm just going to...
I'm already in trouble. You may have noticed that. We launched a legal suit against the government of Quebec over tuition about 10 days ago. So.
Right. I know. I really do want to get to research, and we're running out of time. I in part want to get to research because some organization called the U15 is running advertising on this very podcast, calling on the federal government to increase research funding to universities in the upcoming budget. So what's the case for more research funding for the universities? Merrick, do you want to lead off?
I'd be delighted to. The case is that, first of all, it's good for society. We know that Canada collectively might produce maybe 1.5% of the world's knowledge. We punch though above our weight in terms of the kind of stature that our scholars have around the world, and the admiration that exists for the work that we do here. The research enterprise fuels the economy in all kinds of ways. Research is largely about people, and research funding, by and large, goes to fund graduate students and postdocs who do a huge amount of the work in concert with faculty. So research funding is really about talent development. And what has suffered as a result of the fact that we haven't kept up with the competition is that our ability to produce that talent, to attract it from elsewhere around the world, and to retain it in the case of faculty, is suffering greatly. That talent goes out and works in the economy around us. Graham just spoke eloquently about the impact of Montreal's universities on the Montreal economy. The same is true in Saskatoon. The same is true in Toronto. And so we are depleting the talent base because of our inability to maintain our investments in research. It's also, though, the skill set, the knowledge that talent brings to their employers, which is impacted. There's been a lot of attention in the business press and more generally in Canada in the last little while to the fact that our GDP per capita is declining, that we're becoming less productive per worker over time, that our population is growing faster than our output is. But it also speaks to the fact that the quality of the work being done perhaps is suffering. And I think one of the reasons for that is the fact that Canadian businesses, by and large, have been less willing to hire people with advanced degrees, masters and PhDs, the kinds of people who graduate from the research enterprise. And when they move into the private sector or the public sector, they bring with them an innovative capacity, which can help drive that GDP per capita up rather than the other way around. The other flow that I would point to is, of course, a direct flow of innovation from universities to the economy through things like entrepreneurship. All three of the universities represented here and many more across the country are really bursting at the seams in terms of the number of incubators and accelerators where students and faculty are generating startups based on the research that's being done and commercializing it themselves. I mean, that kind of flow is becoming increasingly important, and we run the risk of choking it off if we're not investing in research adequately. And we do believe that that is a challenge right now. Now, Peter is the chair of the U15, so perhaps he can give us a little bit further reflection on this issue.
Yeah, Peter, I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. But if you could also give us some tangible examples. I mean, I'm super proud that Paul Martin ensured that the first money that came out of the Canadian Foundation for Innovation bought the synchrotron machine for the University of Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What has that synchrotron machine meant for Saskatchewan or Canada? What's the value of having it?
Well, the synchrotron is one example. You know, our vaccine and infectious disease organization labs is another, and maybe one that's, more almost timely. But, I mean, go back to the synchrotron. There's all kinds of pharmaceutical research that goes on there, research to do with devising more drought-resistant crops, you know, really important agricultural research that goes on there that has a real impact on the prosperity of this province, the exports. You take a look at something like VITO, the Vaccine Infectious Disease Organization Labs. Aside from the fact they've worked their way to be one of the top sort of 8 labs in the world in terms of vaccine production for a human pandemic, they've produced all kinds of vaccines that have protected a multi-billion dollar pork industry, helping to ensure that, we can still export pork to all sorts of places in Southeast Asia and China and beyond. You know, this kind of research has direct economic impact. And every university has its own version of this, can tell its own story. But the point is that there's a direct line between research and national Canadian prosperity. And it's not only the applied research. You know, I keep going back to the fact that the different vaccine labs that produce vaccines around the world in the space of 12 or 13 months, and they're going to get it down to 3 months in the next couple of years, is all based on the fact that fundamental research went on in those areas for decades. Wouldn't have been possible otherwise. So whether you look at applied research or you look at fundamental so-called curiosity-driven research, all these things are extremely important, everything from human welfare to prosperity. So back to, you know, some of the tangibles, and I've got the figures in front of me, I won't run through all of them, but the ones that, and it's not just the U15, I mean, the U15 is leading these discussions with government about the imperatives for research funding, but they're intended to support all universities in this country, that this country lags far behind the US, Germany, Australia, in terms of the percentage of GDP that is devoted to R&D. We're less than half of what you see in those countries. And, you know, make no mistake, this is going to have an impact. It isn't just going to have an impact in a year, but it's been going on for a long time. And you take a look at where we are in terms of the OECD and our share in Canada of the population with graduate degrees, were 28th out of 38 OECD members. So, you know, even if you look at it simply from the sort of crass practical perspective of competition with other countries, What that means when we start lagging behind is that we're not going to be the talent magnet that Graham was mentioning much earlier on the show. It's, you know, when people try to decide, where do I want to try to fulfill my academic aspirations, either as a student, a graduate student, a postdoctoral fellow, a faculty member, and the really talented ones look around the world and make those decisions. You want Canada to be signaling that this is the place to be. And one of the ways to signal that is the government's investment in research. People look at that carefully.
Just so, Peter, the budget's a month from now. Do you have a precise ask of the government of Canada?
Oh, yeah. We do. So, you know, there are several funding agencies, three in particular, plus one that is involved in funding scientific infrastructure. That's where something like the Canadian Light Source Synchrotron comes in that you were referring to before. So we're asking those granting agencies to be funded so that their budgets are increased by 10% a year for the next 5 years. We're looking to a one-time increase of 50% to the value of federally funded graduate student scholarships and PDFs, postdoctoral fellows. So, by the way, David, just to put that in perspective, that value of graduate scholarships that are federally funded has been stagnant since when? 2007. So
part of me is awfully tempted to point out what else happened around that time, but I won't.
that's a 53% decline in the value of graduate scholarships that are federally funded, and we want to double the number of them because we're only supporting 1.8% of all graduate students at the moment. So you wrap all that together, and that's a $1.9 billion ask over 5 years. Make no mistake, that's not luxurious. The U.S. put in $81 billion in their National Science Foundation through the CHIPS and Science Act. And if you, convert for population, what we're asking for is a fraction of that.
Yeah. They're playing with poker chips down there, though. I mean, the amount of money they throw at everything is unbelievable.
David, can I just add something here? I think there's another factor, which is, you know, to me, this question gets to what's Canada's ambition in terms of its role and the place it wants to occupy in the world. So for me, if you're the government of Canada, you're the steward of incredible responsibilities, whether those are natural resources, whether it's the forestry industry in northern British Columbia, whether it's rivers and oceans. You've also laid down, a target to be a leader in certain sectors, such as agri-food, such as personalized health or precision medicine, or such as electrification. If you want to execute and actually be a global leader in those areas, you need to invest in research talent. And if you want to be able to protect the critical resources that are part of the fabric of this society, not just the natural resources, but our social resources, you need to invest in understanding those dynamics as well. And those are research investments. Those are investments in trying to advance knowledge. Those are investments in trying to better connect the scientific discoveries with the needs of industry in the public sector. And those are also investments in understanding how important human thought and behavior is to the acceptance of change, to our ability to cope with society around us. So for me, it's partly a choice of whether Canada is willing to become dependent on the research, more and more dependent on the research that other countries are prepared to invest in, or wants to actually double down on its own level investment to ensure that Canada is seen as a leader and as a partner, because research is increasingly international and increasingly collaborative. And if you don't invest, you're going to be left behind in those collaborative ventures.
What happened to the federal government's cluster strategy? That they had five super clusters. I think universities were at the heart of it. I had heard Peter, good things about the protein supercluster at one point. I don't know what's going on. But was that not a federally driven research strategy?
Mm-hmm. Well, just very quickly, yeah, the Protein Industries Canada supercluster that's based in Saskatchewan is, yeah, extremely active. And the point of it is to really bring academia together with industry to move ahead in any one of these five areas that Canada feels that it has potential or real preeminence in. So, yeah, the Protein Industries Canada supercluster, which has a lot to do with creating plant-based proteins on the assumption that, you know, the world population is going to increase by 2 billion by 2050. You're going to have to double food production. It can't all be in the form of animal-based protein. So there's a real need for that one that I'm most knowledgeable about, and it's doing extremely well. In fact, I was just in Singapore. That was a lot of the work that we were doing was in the plant-based protein area. And I think, you know, I can't speak for the other superclusters, but I would imagine they're doing well. Certainly this one is.
All right, we're running really out of time, up against the wall. And I want to quickly get one last thought from each of you on this subject. And Merrick, we'll start with you. If you were the king, if you were king for a day, what would you change about provincial government policy toward the post-secondary education sector?
What I would change is I would like to see much more generous and sustained investment in the system, recognizing all of the social benefits that arise from investments in higher education. Too much of the burden has fallen onto the shoulders of students and their families, and yet we know that taxpayers in general benefit tremendously. So there's a rationale, and that would be what I would change.
Great. Graham?
Well, I'd certainly echo what Merrick said. I think the key would be around sustainable and predictable funding going forward. And in the case of Quebec, in light of what's happened in the last a few months, equitable funding as well for all institutions.
Right, great. And Peter?
Well, yeah, it would, you know, it's too bad that we have to be having discussions about funding, right, being at the source of what we want, but it's inevitable and it's imperative. And I think the problem is that we're seen as a cost, not an investment. And if I were king for a day, I'd love to wake up the day after I was the king for a day and realize that provincial governments and the federal government are seeing it as an investment, seeing universities as investments in youth, in the future, in research, and all the things we've been talking about, and not just some kind of cost or drag on the system. And the countries that do, you know, will prosper. And Canada has always, we're at an unfortunate moment, and I hope it is just a moment we can change that narrative.
Gentlemen, what a conversation. I can't believe, thank you so much for your time. This has been so illuminating, so interesting to me. And the notion, to anybody that taught me in school or university, that I would ever have convened a panel of university presidents would have been ludicrous. But here I am, nonetheless, with my
university. It would probably have been ludicrous for us to imagine we were going to be university presidents too. David. So it goes both ways.
There we go. Well, you were extremely gracious with your time. Thank you so much. I need to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail, all the hurly-burlyites out there who watched or listened to today's show, and you three gentlemen, thank you for your time, and Godspeed to you in your work.
Thank you, David. You. A pleasure. Cheers.
Bye.
Thanks very much. Bye now. Hurly-burly.